here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Then let's start with going around and just saying what your first name is, and if there's any particular reason why you're interested in time. And you don't have to have a particular reason. Maybe it's just a general interest, or you happen to be free. But sometimes there's real specific reasons why people are interested. So can we start back?
Lately, you say things ahead of before you like understand them yourself. So lately, I've been saying that like I want to trust my own sense of timing, and I really like that idea, but I'm not quite sure what I mean by it yet. So
that's cool.
Yeah,
it is cool.
And I was especially interested in this session because I often view time as how can I be most productive with time, and I would like to learn a different way to see time.
Thanks for coming. Charlie.
You.
Not sure about time. I don't have as much time left as I used to, so I'm thinking about that. But also trying to be useful with my time. I mean, I just spent the day in the laundry and it was so good. I just felt so good about it. Mm. So.
Good.
And it seems to me that at Holden, they find several things every time that you might be doing, and you can only do one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm interested in time because I feel there's tension in the way that I want to use my time. Like I feel like I really just want to dwell and just be present and be relational, but I often feel like a pressure to like go and to always be on the move and to always be productive. And so I also see the merit in that. It's just kind of like this tension. Maybe I can find some sort of balance. I don't know.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks.
I'm actually interested in this class, not necessarily because I want to know the value and the importance of time, either in relation to where I'm coming from and also the time here in the United States or in Western Hemisphere. But just because I came to this class because I love learning, and I believe in intellectual progress, and I like to train my mind. I like to see how, you know, people do in teaching, in mentoring knowledge to other people. And yeah, I see a being of me, mm-hmm. in relation to time right now, but yeah, I love it.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The discussion yesterday, mm-hmm. about time, so like, and then we just said, how did we miss this Monday thing? So we said today was repeat. We're like, perfect.
So it's much more in depth about what you talked about yesterday.
Yeah, okay,
so good.
Time seems to structure most of our lives, so there's definitely that tension, and that's a good word for it. How do you live in the tension of timing structures that you have control over and don't have over.
I grew up in a house where we were always late, and after I got out of my own, I found that that was not the best thing for me because I was losing out on so much being late, and later I learned that other people are losing out because I'm late. They don't get me involved in the process, and so I want to. I already know technically that that's important, but I want to be able to reinforce that in myself, that the value of my time is something to me, but other people might have a different value.
Okay, interesting. Thoughtful. Thanks.
And I feel like it's not an uncommon topic here at Holden to say how time is made right here. And I am excited to hear about that in a bit more detail.
Mm-hmm. Does not surprise me that time is a frequent topic here. Yeah?
I
I too would like a different relationship with time. Not like I have what I think I would like, but then it's very difficult to live it out. Thinking about that.
Yes. Thanks.
And I love thinking about the fact that time is a social construct and a force of standardization in our modern culture especially. I say that, you know, with a liability around the word modern. And so I'm quite interested in how cultures understand time differently, because it helps me understand how we've made up things about time and what it says about us, and also who I could be and who we could be.
It's been fascinating for me to study. Oh, we've got some folks up here too. Hi. Do you want to say hi, or you want to just... It's been fascinating for me to have the privilege to study it. I'm in communication studies, and my last sabbatical, which was several years ago, I had about 10 weeks that I just spent just reading everything that I could about time and culture, and, you know, in particular, because intercultural communication is an interest of mine. But what I soon found out was that not only in physics and in anthropology, you know, some obvious disciplines, so many disciplines study time, or time is related to in so many different ways. And so the questions that they ask and the understandings about what time is vary tremendously in business versus economics or literature or leisure studies, philosophy, religion, I mean, all of it, right? And so if you have backgrounds in anything, right, you might fruitfully just see how it's studied in the disciplines in which you're most interested. I'm going to focus in on mostly psychology and intercultural communication. So the way that the kinds of questions that are asked are different, and in these particular ones. But these also interact in ways that are, I think, fruitful for combining them in this discussion. So... it was very hard for me to begin. I was like drowning in time literature for a while, and I just had to put some boundaries up. And even that alone was mind-blowing. I loved it. So what I'm going to do today here is start out with a little clip from, it's an RSA Animate. It's a little animated feature that goes very quickly, and it's a psychological approach to understanding the psychology of time, and it blends into cultural time as well. So we'll start out on that, and then I'll share with you in my discipline what are the there's two major cultural time orientations that are often talked about, and I'll explain those, and we'll sort of position ourselves inside what could be a spectrum. It's often not posited as a spectrum, but I think it is. And we'll talk about how values are taught along with how what we're taught, because time is a discipline. I mean, the way that I have seen it, it's like a very disciplinary sort of idea here that, you know, keep a watch on people, right? And like that was literally associated with, you know, post-industrial society, keeping a watch on your employees, right? And so we use it to discipline ourselves and to discipline others in a way that what I hope to do is point out some of the ways that we learn to judge ourselves and others, and in an attempt to loosen that judgment and to show ourselves why we feel bad about how we do or don't manage our time, right? Because most people feel like there's something kind of off about their balance or about their approach. And I hear that a lot. And what I hope to do is take a non-judgmental approach, but also point out how we learn to judge ourselves mostly, right? So socialization into a value structure, and then just a little bit of a prelude. And I want to talk about what you want to talk about. And so I'm very happy for you to hop in there, raise questions, ideas, thoughts, concerns, what have you. So please just hop in whenever you feel like it. So first, this is going to take just a minute probably to pull up. If anybody has a psych background, Philip Zimbardo is the narrator here, and it's the Zimbardo of Stanford Prison Experiments back in the 70s. He studied, he spent quite a bit of time studying time, and he recommends a book in here as soon as it comes up, called The Geography of Time, which I also highly recommend. And the geography of anything, it's a spatial, right? It's a spatial discipline, so you can have a geography of time. And that's the name of this book, looking at time in different places, in different spaces, right? Maybe I do need Jonah.
I thought I saw, maybe I'm seeing things. I thought I saw a little subtle line, because I saw the arrow.
Uh-huh.
So just try to move the mouse again. Are you moving? Yeah, and I can see vaguely in the corner there. It just looks like maybe it just needs to be brightened. I'm not sure.
Is it up on your computer?
Yeah, I can see that there on the screen.
I can see that, but
yeah,
where is...
Is it on your computer?
There's Jonah right there.
Here we go.
Oh, there we go.
Nope, that's not it.
It was trying to launch to the YouTube. Hello. I'm up here, sorry.
Hi. Yeah. Yeah, and this is what I have. We can talk a little bit about Philip Zimbardo and others while this is happening, but...
Sharon, I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, the, like, Latin root for time and, like, for the word time, do you know any of, like, the origin of just the word time?
The origin of just the word? No, although I know there's lots of folks here who can talk about Kronos and Kairos and, and like, different, in religion in particular, kind of the way that, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
Does anybody else?
Well, the Latin word for time is tempus.
Tempus?
And two of the letters.
Hey, you did it.
Is that it?
Yeah. Sorry. Tempus?
Tempus.
And temporarily.
There's some similarity there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That reminds me of, I know Spanish is tiempo.
Tiempo.
Yeah,
no,
just like
the, I was sure that, yeah.
Watching on YouTube worked, yeah.
Yeah. And then you just go back to PowerPoint. This might, hopefully it works, but we're checking on
the
phones. So what we have discovered in 30 years of research, there's six main time zones that people live in. Two focused on the past, two on the present, and two on the future. The people who focus on the past either remember all the good old times, successes, happy birthdays, nostalgia. These are the people who keep the family record, the family books, who have the family rituals. There are other people who focus only on regret, only on failure, only on all the things that went wrong. So we call those focused past positive or past negative. There are two ways to be present-oriented. The most obvious is to be hedonistic, that you live for pleasure and you avoid pain. You seek knowledge, you seek sensation. There are other people who are present-oriented because they say, it doesn't pay to plan. My life is fated. Fated by my religion, fated by my poverty, fated by the conditions that I'm living under. Most of us are here because we are future-oriented, that we have learned to work rather than play, to resist temptation. But there's another way to be future-oriented. Depending on your religion, life begins after the death of the mortal body. To be future-oriented, you have to trust that when you make a decision about the future, it's going to carry out. If you have great inflation, you don't put money in a bank because you can't trust the future. If you have if there's instability in your family, adults can't keep their promises to you. The closer you are to the equator, the more present-oriented you are. The more you're in an environment where climate doesn't change, it gives you a set of imagining sameness rather than change. Protestants everywhere have higher gross national product than Catholic countries, in part because of the Protestant ethic, because of the notion that you work hard to succeed to demonstrate that you are God's chosen people. My family comes from Sicily, and in Italy there is a political movement called La Liga to cut Italy in half, to have North Italy and South Italy, cut it just below Tuscany. The people in North say, we do all the work. The people in the South are lazy, they're like children, they want to have babies, have 3-hour dinners, etc. People in the South say, they're not Italian, they're German and Austrian, you know. They have yogurt instead of pasta. They take the lunch in a paper bag. And in the recent election, the Liga got 14% of the national vote. It turns out, it is accurate. We've done research to say people in the North tend to be, on a scale, much more future-oriented. People in the South tend to be more past-oriented or present hedonistic. And so my family is Sicilian. And I come from Sicily. I go back every year. I start an educational foundation. We send high school kids to college and set up computer labs. And I'm talking about some of this stuff. And a man comes up and says, I'm a poet. I live with words. It wasn't until I heard your talk that I realized there's no future tense verb in Sicilian dialect. I said, what do you mean? There was, is, there's no will be. He said, that's why nothing gets done. I didn't realize it because we never plan. So again, here's how when you have a number of people who share a certain time perspective, then it does come to characterize a nation. The same way, if you have a Catholic nation where people tend to be present or past-oriented, rather than a Protestant nation where in general people tend to be more future-oriented, it affects you in very profound ways. So there's a wonderful book called The Geography of Time, and it's written by a dear friend of mine, Robert Levine, who's a social psychologist. And he actually literally went around the world doing wonderful experiments. He looks at what he calls the pace of life. See, time perspective is how people divide their own experience into partitions, time zones. Another kind of time orientation is your sense of duration. How much time has expired while you're sitting in a dentist's office before they start drilling? How much time has expired when you've been waiting in line? How much time has expired when you're having fun, or I'd say. So time duration is totally a function of whether you're bored, whether you're excited or not. And what he does is, he shows that in different cultures, people have a different pace of life. And you do this very simply. You sit in a cafe, and you mark up 100 meters, and as people pass, you start a stopwatch. You see how fast people walk. You go to a post office, and on a piece of paper you say, I'd like, you know, 3 pounds of you know, this postage or 10 euros, you see how long it takes. So there's a bunch of these measures. And it turns out you can identify cultures as a different pace of life and now cities. And he shows in America you can rank 60 cities according high pace of life and low pace of life. And the ones that have the highest pace of life, men have the most coronary problems. This becomes part of your whole way of life. We all begin life as present humans.
Okay. Woo! Yeah, that's a lot all at once. So I can play it again if you want to after we talk about it, or we can just kind of continue on from there. But, let me get out of this for a second. What are your... I think there's stuff missing in the five minutes that I think still exists inside the structure that he talks about, such as there's ways of being present oriented, for example, that are not hedonistic and not necessarily fated, right? So
thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, Zen Buddhism, I mean, is all about mindfulness. And mindfulness is in the literature on being present, being wholly and fully present.
Well, it doesn't have to be hedonistic, does it?
Absolutely not.
Okay, good.
In fact, it can be an incredible gift to whoever's in front of you to be very present-oriented with them. That's an incredible gift.
I discovered the older you get, the more mindful you have to be, or you do dumb stuff, dumber stuff than you did when you were younger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So let's talk about that for a little bit. What stood out for you? What do you want to talk about?
Well,
Joe.
As someone who also lives with words, that part about not having the language for future. He deduced that that's the reason why they don't live into that, because they don't have the language for it. So yeah. This relationship between what we have language for and the way we live our lives. Like, I've often kind of wondered that. And the other thing that struck me was that one of the last things he said about how we all start off as present-oriented, and maybe everything else is socially constructed, that we're, like, socialized to live into. I don't know.
It is, in fact, his argument. If I played a little more,
okay.
he would have said next that his belief, Zimbardo's belief, is that schools are designed to socialize us out of being present hedonistic little beasts and into either future-oriented or sometimes past-oriented, right? Okay. That it's like a civilizing function to, you know, the way that we handle time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can fault schools for that, because the schools are trying to do what parents do because parents are working and they don't have time to be with the kids full-time.
Yeah.
If we don't become aware of the future, if we don't build or remember the past, we make terrible mistakes over and over again.
Yeah.
If we don't remember the future or think about the future, then we don't build anything, because we don't need it. We don't think that we need it. And later on we find out, gee, if I had just put in a water spigot, I wouldn't have had to go down to the creek every single day of my life for the last 70 years.
I'm with you about, I mean, no, that's not a, that wasn't a criticism of schools at all. Yeah, I think schools have, there's so much pressure to do lots of things. Yeah.
I was struck by the idea of the, like, sense of duration of things. So, because, like, when I experience, like, real, like, small, wonderful moments, I actually have this, like, huge, like, take up so much of my energy that they feel so huge, even though it might have just been like 2 minutes of my time, right? And so I feel, when I'm trying to think of, like, I don't really grasp that until I'm like digesting my day of like what felt long and short and things like that. So I wonder if sense of, I don't know, that's just an interesting idea.
You know what would be really cool? Like, visually, if how your day felt to you, the metric of a minute is a minute is a minute is how a lot, often, that's what time use studies are, right? How did you use each minute? But that does not begin to get at the experience of time, about how people feel their lives. And so your 24 hours could have been, like, this 2 minutes could have taken up that much.
Right.
Like it just feels like, and so that, like, what each minute feels like, the metric is different, and it is absolutely fascinating to me. And how, so each, how do you make sense of that?
I think we fill our heads with I don't know, time bits, and if something is really interesting, we put a lot of memory bits into that time, and if it's maybe that's not exactly true, but I think different times we store different amounts of memory for certain things, and the more you store, the longer you thought it took.
I'm wondering, you know, time is a measurement, but I don't think that's all time is. It just tends to be the thing that we want time mostly to be in our culture, here in the United States anyway. And that there's probably radically different ways to experience time besides just measurements, which is where I like to live, is outside the things that can be measured.
Yeah.
Like, the important things in life have to be gathered fresh every day would be a quote that comes to my mind right now.
I agree. There are different ways of experiencing time, and that's part of what we'll get at. And there's even different ways of measuring it. Like, even if all we're interested in is a measurement or a metric, even that varies, and it varies according to values in a society or in an individual life. So if you're interested in language, if you're interested in, and I've read bits and pieces, it's like I know a little bit in a lot of areas. And so, but there's this one book that Joe might be interested in. It's called When Languages Die. And one of, and what goes with them when that language goes away. Mm-hmm. And one of the chapters is on calendars and timekeeping systems that are rooted in small languages that, you know, that what can we learn from other, the words that people have and the metrics they use and the calendar systems they have that are, that go away when the language goes away. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's some things that, like the clock itself, the clocks are available everywhere. Right? But what the clock means and how people respond to it and how it's incorporated into their lives is radically different in different cultures. And we learn it. There, Edward T. Hall is a cultural anthropologist who suggests that time is the central thing to understand about a culture, how they view time. And so this is what psychologists look at, and I think this is really cool. But he also started to get at how nations and countries and cultures can be characterized when large groups of people share a certain time perspective. It can characterize a nation, right? And the United States of America is a very multicultural nation, and we still have a tendency towards a particular cultural time that is very strong and that disciplines a lot of us, right? And so that's what I'm going to go to next. But somebody else had some thoughts percolating? No other thoughts percolating? Okay. So, did you want to see this again? Or move on?
We're good about it.
No. You good?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll move on. The thing I added here is that Zimbardo talked about past, present, and future orientations. There are also those who talk about a timeline orientation to add to it. So it is a more of an analytical approach where you might learn from the past and it impacts what you do in the present, and you can sort of take that those lessons into your future thoughts about the future. So this is a more analytical view that is in some models that Zimbardo didn't discuss. Let's see. The stress of the pace shows up a lot in when I'm going to talk to you a little bit about cultural time orientations with monochronic time. So in psychology, there's lots, you know, multiple ways that people sort of dissect kind of the experience of time. In the intercultural literature, intercultural communication, there are two major time orientations that are talked about, and they're often positioned over against each other. And so I'm going to talk to you here about these two major, monochronic and polychronic. And I would absolutely imagine there's way more than just two ways of culturally understanding time. And so in no way am I saying that these are the only options. In fact, that's a big criticism I have of a lot of social science research on culture writ large, is that there just are like variables, like culture like variable, you know. So we will mess with that in any event. This is what is most common in the literature. Monochronic. Students of mine wrote a song. Monochronic time, one thing at a time. Monochronic, a line, a ribbon extending out into the future. So monochronic time is an idea that the clock disciplines us, but it's a singular focus, so we imagine one thing at a time. Clock driven in the sense that there's a time for things. There's a time for things that fit into your day. And so the things that are associated with the time. Imagine if none of those things were associated with the time. Okay? That's more polychronic. Monochronic, clock driven, arbitrary in the sense that it can be dissociated from the thing. If you've ever eaten a meal, not when you were hungry, but because it was time, then that's a monochronic thing. And I am very monochronic. I was raised that way. I operate that way, and I have 15-minute appointments, and I use my Google calendars every day. Right? And I schedule my day that way. It's a singular focus, and it's the clock. I keep pointing up here. There's no clock there.
It's
behind my board. Oh, good. Thank you. Okay. There's a clock. Right? It's hidden from me. And if you get nervous, because if you don't know what time it is, what time is it? Right? We are very rooted in the clock, right? And I was taught that well, and my life is ordered that way. I also am a professor, and I have a lot of student advisees, and I have a lot of students. Vicky and I both, our offices are right across from each other. And I can, you know, she has students who come into her office and just need to be there and sit and talk. And there's a tension that I feel sometimes when I have somebody come into my office and they need to talk to me. And yet I have an appointment with somebody else. In a monochronic system, I might say, let's schedule another time because I've got somebody else waiting, right? The schedule supersedes the relationship. And it's not because I don't care about that student, but it's because I've learned that to respect time, I go by the appointment, right? So there's a time for things. And sometimes I might mess that up, and then I have to apologize. Like, oh, sorry, I'm late. I had something important going on, right? The apology, where we apologize about time, really can tell us something about our cultural time orientation. So if I'm 3 minutes late to class, I'm like, sorry, class. You know, because they'll be mad at me. They'll be mad because I'm wasting their time because they had to be there and I'm supposed to be there. And that's very, very monochronic, right? How would that be different then in polychronic? Polychronic time is sometimes called event time. So clock time versus event time. In event time, there's more of an organic the things happen when they're supposed to happen. They start when they're supposed to start, and they end when they're supposed to end. Mm-hmm. So, and everybody knows that. It's a shared thing. It's not just a singular psychological phenomenon of how I happen to be past-oriented. When we're talking about a culture, we're talking about a shared system of understanding. So if I lived in a polychronic culture, truly, and I had time, I mean, everybody has a clock, like everybody gets it, but it's more like a suggestion. This doesn't tell you exactly when to begin and end things. It's like kind of a suggestion. So if I need to sit and talk with you for an hour, because that's what we need, and I'd sort of told somebody I might be somewhere else, it's okay. There's no shame. There's no blame. People get it. When any American student goes to study abroad, students of mine who went to study in Sevilla in Spain would be like, the professor would come in a half an hour late, and like sometimes the students would wander in, and nobody seemed to care, and it was hard for them to sort of get used to that, but that's, you don't have to apologize for that. You're not shamed for that. It's the system is looser. And there's pro and con to both of these. There's pro and con to both. But what we learn very often is that there's only pro to my way, and there's a con to the other way. So that's kind of what we learn. So polychronic can be multiple operations. If I'm running a store and you walk in, I might like chit-chat with you and chit-chat with you, and another customer comes in, and I'm not going to just drop this and go there because it's more people-oriented, and that's just an understanding. Business takes much longer in, you know, working with polychronic time. Anyone who studied international business knows that's one of the first things that you learn about, right? Except that you don't always learn to respect it. Sometimes they learn to put up with it, but that's not the same thing as to learn to respect what's really a core value there, right? Both monochronic and polychronic societies have, people have families they love and friends they adore, and it's not that, but it's very easy for somebody from one to say, you don't respect this relationship, or you don't be, it's so easy to just denigrate the other, right? So when it says this is more people driven, it's like it's a bit, it can be a bit more present focused in some ways, right? But it is, the relationship supersedes the clock or the calendar, the schedule. So that's more event time. I can take questions. I'm going to, I have a bunch more information about it, so I'll unpack it even more. But again, hop in there if you have thoughts. Vicki?
I'm curious if you come across this notion, because you're talking about the liabilities of just having two choices.
Yeah.
In the dichotomy.
Yeah.
I was wondering if in polychronic cultures, if you ran into more options for experiencing time. I know you're sort of pulling this from literature, which might have been derived, but I'm curious if you've hinted or found any hints of that sort of moving outside of that binary or two, which
moving
is really
outside.
Hard to do in academics, I think.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to get it. To get it out of my head, I'm going to say the first thing that came into my head, which is not an answer to your question, but it, or maybe it is. There's a novel, there's a piece of fiction by Alan Lightman called, he's a physicist. He wrote a book called Einstein's Dreams. And in it, every chapter, time is different. And it's fantastical, it seems fantastical, except some of those chapters are really, they're probably possible. And so in this book, Einstein is, you know, is a character. And again, each chapter, in one chapter, time runs backwards. In another chapter, time stops at some of these memories and lingers there. And it lingers in these spaces. In another chapter, time is sticky, or it sort of stops and starts. My students loved the chapter where time goes faster the higher you are. Like on the mountain, it goes faster. You age faster, right? And then in the valley, and you had to decide, and there were, you know, there was, like, it was more expensive to live, you know, like wherever time went more slowly. Or, I mean, there was an economics to it. It was, and it's kind of amazing. But some of it actually scientifically seems like it is possible. Time is different in space, like near black holes where, you know. So that just fired me. Yeah. Somebody else had thoughts? Kate?
Well, I'm wondering about routine.
Yeah.
How routine plays into this, because it seems like monochronic would be very reliant on routine and predictability, and because I'm trying to figure out like what's like a healthy routine for my own life.
Yeah.
I just can't seem to find it. Right. I'm going, okay, am I polychronic? Because I just cannot. I drop everything when it, like something relational comes.
Yep.
In my day, and I go, okay, well, I can get the other stuff done, or and I can miss these things because.
Yeah. Because I value, because I'm
prioritizing
this.
So I'm just wondering, does the literature touch on routine when it talks about this at all? Or
the thing that comes to my mind is a dialectic, and that's a dialectical tension. A dialectic is it's things that seem like they're opposing, that seem like they're opposites, but they're not. You need them both. And there's a dialectic that, at least in this theory, that we all share, which is a need for some need for routine and some need for spontaneity. Mm-hmm. And some people have a high need for routine and a low need for spontaneity, and others, it can change, right? It can, but that I haven't seen. I can't recall it being related to time. It is, though. But I can point you to some literature about that tension, and how, in my interpersonal, like with friendships and with romantic relationships and family relationships, that is a very big issue of how do we fit our times together, right? And that theory of relational dialectics says it's ever ongoing, moving, and there are things that people do to balance it. Some people balance it by having a routine of doing something together, but making it be different
Yeah.
every time, right? And so it meets both needs.
Oh, yeah.
You know. So there's ways that people sort of imaginatively handle that tension.
I think I'm realizing that I have learned very well to be monochronic in order to get along.
Yeah.
To be successful. But I know that I am very polychronic. When I work on something, it doesn't matter to me personally how long it takes. Mm-hmm. It can take 5 days to do something that maybe somebody else could get done in a day. But I have to be monochronic about it in order to be successful and needed.
I think that's a good insight.
In this society.
In this society. Even the way you said that, you said, I could do it in 5 days versus 1 day. That's a metric. That's a measurement that says that's sort of separate from the thing itself. But you're saying you value the thing itself, and you would like to spend the time that it takes to do that thing.
Right, because it would pleasure me more because I would have a better experience out of it.
Yes, and business is not structured like that here in the United States most of the time. Neither are most of our systems. And there are things that we gain from that, and there are things that we lose. And but we don't often even know that there are options. And so I put this up here, like posited as a dichotomy, like this is. So I mean, we're often taught in the U.S. this is the right way, this is the wrong way. And by the right way, we mostly mean efficient, right? So when I say posited as a dichotomy. Again, interpersonal relationships, as I said before, with monochronic time, the schedule tells us where we're supposed to be, and the schedule is subordinate to interpersonal relations with more polychronic thinking, right? Polychronic time orientation suggests more interrelationship. It suggests more interdependence, more of a collectivist way of imagining self and society, for example. Monochronic, these are not the same, but monochronic goes really well with individualist thinking, right? And because, you know, and so that relates to some of those things right there. Vicki, you had your hand?
I just was remembering conversations this morning as we were talking to someone about parenthood.
Yeah.
And that the notion of when you talk about relationships and the subordination of relationships and, say, parenting or having a child, even in our culture, it seems to be an area of shifting. This is when you pull that slide up, it made me think of that.
Say more about that.
Well, I think there's such a directness involved in nurturing a young person that's the relationship, right? And so this morning and other times talking to parents about how, and other workshops also, about how that other small person who's relying on you becomes, that relationship becomes the clock in many ways. And so you see people with infants who don't sleep the same, like it's not a schedule. That's somehow there's a different clock, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Huge. I've talked to, lots and lots of parents that talk about, like, good luck managing your time with a toddler, right? And just a couple days ago, I forget who, but when mom was saying, well, maybe it's okay that it takes 10 minutes to get from the car to the grocery store, but how hard is it for us to do that? Mm-hmm. That is hard. That is like a practice in patience for me. And if I think I should be there and back, right? There's a time allotted that's supposed to be for certain things. And right. Whereas maybe, what does it take to say that's okay? Yeah.
So I think you add to that, that's why it's so nice to have aunts and uncles and cousins and grandmas and grandpas that can go to the store. And, you know, when I take my grandson, who wants to weigh every single piece of fruit, I don't care for that. That's right. These right. ones that are coming already bite my head.
Right.
But, parents have they have other things that they get done. They can't spend 3 days
yes.
in the grocery store.
That's true. There is a book about family and time, about, you know, how families can negotiate this tension. It's because everybody most people experience that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Way back when I was taking a social class and they were talking about what happens when all the women go to work, and this was about 1980, mm-hmm. they said within 20 years almost all the women will be working also. And what disappeared was campfire, scouting, 4-H, and all the adult things. A lot of people don't do things like rotary or things like that until they're retired.
Right.
And then we get to do it again. But the women aren't doing it anymore, and they are exhausted.
Yes.
And that's what we learned in 2000, near 2000. They said, by that time, the women will be too exhausted, and all these things are going to disappear. And they are. In my area,
yeah.
they are disappearing. And the other thing is, they're not being paid.
Right.
And there's a lot of them that don't have a man to help them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at their time. They don't even have time to breathe.
No. Mm-hmm. And what it takes to just survive, I mean, just to have a roof over your head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's not a lot of support for families. There's not a lot of support, I mean, in this country. And most people need to work. They have to work.
They have to because they don't pay the men enough either.
No, it's a problem. I mean,
money makes up yes. for time.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Poverty, people in poverty have no time at all.
Yeah.
Three jobs.
Yeah. That's absolutely right.
It's crazy. We're nuts.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah.
No, I had my say.
Yeah.
And we agree with
say it again, I'll give you this.
Yeah.
I'll give you this microphone. Because I think you're right.
And the country is a lot richer now that women are working. It's richer because we now know more. Because the women are better educated and they know more.
There's a huge lot of need in this country still. Increasing, growing, desperate need. Yeah. And some of that, I would argue, comes out of an individualistic mindset and some in the ways that we imagine who's responsible for what. So an individual is responsible for a nuclear family, or as opposed to a whole community operating with you know each other's interests in mind, right? Mm-hmm. And this feeds into that in some ways, sort of philosophically, individualism and monochronic thinking.
Yeah.
And so, but in this dichotomy here, Nick, what you were talking about in just a minute ago was your task measurement output in time versus output in the thing itself, right? The goal of the organization, of the family, of the company, right? There's a whole host of attributes and norms that you can find in the literature, some that are obvious and some that are sort of less so, right, that attend to different kinds of time orientations that influence us all the time. And so, but Vicki imagined my, you know, you predicted my worry about a dichotomy. So dichotomies are problematic in lots of ways. What are some ways? You already said some.
Well, it's just a either or, and all of us, anytime there's an either or, it seems like it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
It's just I don't know what the right word is. There's a mirror that's loosely resembles, but most individuals are people. I mean, it just doesn't. I don't know, it's like when you get to check yes or no. I'm always like a...
Me too, I'm always making new bosses. I'm like, no, it depends, right? And so, I mean, there's lots of problems with the dichotomy. And so for us to mess with that dichotomy, let's just, you know, not imagine it as it has to be one or the other. I mean, I honestly am not in control of all the systems under which I'm operating. I can't tell my boss, oh, I'm going to operate on polychronic time from now on. Like, I don't have that kind of agency. And so it's not, I'm not saying critically, you know, if we just critically think, we can change the way that we live, right? Mm-hmm. We can't. But in some ways, we might be able to, in some small ways, right? Because my firm belief is that the way that we learn is a way to sort of smash out other possibilities. And if we just sort of open it up, we can possibly learn new skill sets or sort of practice new skill sets and not shame or judge others. So what I'm going to do is share with you some of the things that I found in my sabbatical research as I read and read and read and read. And then I thought I'm going to go through and see how we teach about time literally. Because most of the ways that we learn about time, of course, are just in socializing and how we grow up and how we learn when the bell rings at school or how, I mean, most of the time it's not literally learning about time. But I went in and said, I'm literally going to look at textbooks and say, how is it presented here and how are we teaching about what cultural time systems are as a reflection. And all of these are textbooks geared to American audiences, all written by American citizens. So there's a normalization of Western time that is very obvious once I went through and discovered some of these definitions I'll show you. So socializing into value norms. I know you can read. I'll read aloud too, just in case. But the way here's a one definition from a textbook. The way people use time can result in misunderstandings because people from monochronic time cultures are used to carrying out one conversation at a time, whereas people who use polychronic time carry several conversations simultaneously, which confuses and frustrates the users of monochronic time.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I've seen this happen so many times in my life. Like, yeah. I can relate. I see particular instances in my memory. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. That totally happened.
Yep.
That's why.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yep, 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 yep. Yeah. What's the problem with that?
It's judgmental. I mean, it's very clear which way you're supposed to be.
It,
because yes. Otherwise you're going to confuse and frustrate.
Right.
The majority, or who we're supposed to be, right?
Over and over, I saw subtle indications, or sometimes not so subtle indications, that monochronic time is the way to be. Mm-hmm. And it can be frustrating, and that's intercultural communication can be, of course, confusing or frustrating. But it's never, ever posited as frustrating for polychronic persons, only for monochronic. There's no parallel treatment of potential confusion at crazy monochronic behavior, right? And so there's this assumed monochronic normalcy that in this literature, so I'm going to give you like three or four more examples. And so, but I had many examples of that. So for example, too many Asians. Time is more of a relational issue rather than a clock time issue. And in some less developed countries, life moves to the rhythms of nature, the day, the seasons, the year. Such human interventions as seconds, minutes, hours, and weeks have no real meaning. What's the problem? What's the problem with that?
It seems that the rhythms of nature have no meaning. It just absolutely means the opposite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that the best, like, you know, these things don't matter as much as seconds, minutes, hours, weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what else?
I read that modern always assumes a subject, and so what I'm seeing here is that modern is always written from basically a Western,
mm-hmm.
that, and then the subject is always Asian or anything that's not the.
That's the pattern.
Not Western time. Yeah. So there's something less than, or it's less developed, or it's less. Such human interventions as seconds, minutes, hours, and weeks have no real meaning? So the thing here, again, polychronic persons in this literature assumed less developed. They don't understand mechanized time. There's this like, you just don't get it. We're supposed to meet at 12:15 and you're not here. You just clearly don't get, or you don't value time, or you don't respect it, right? And so there's a tendency to sort of judge that. Monochronic persons are not positioned as ignorant of anything. They're not held accountable for what they ostensibly do not know or how they do not act. Because this, you know, like what they, like they don't get that, right? That those other people, they don't get that. If we flipped the bias, if we took something like this and flipped it, a parallel sentence might read, monochronic persons, such as Americans, move to the beat of a mechanical time. Monochronic persons are not in tune with nature. Such natural happenings as the sun rising or birds migrating or normal biological aging have no real meaning. I made that up. See, I made that. Yeah. Thank you. But that's what the parallel sentence might read, and that's not true, right? That doesn't get at it. And it doesn't get at it the other way around either. Right. It does. It misses something. It misses the meaning of the cultural time system from the other's perspective, which is they can both be beautiful. There's loving relationships in both and everything on the spectrum, but this is what we do.
I think monochronic persons know that. They're
I do too.
The sun rising, the birds migrating, the normal biological aging do have meaning, but more as a painting on the wall than a sculpture.
Say more about that.
It's, we pay lip service to it, I think, as a monochronic society. A polychronic society would say, this is important first. And if it takes a while to produce this, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it takes a day or 5 days, as long as we do it. And we agree that it's finished, that we're together, that we agree.
Interesting. Other thoughts on that in response to Nick? Kate?
Yeah, so I just wrote down natural versus mechanical time.
Yeah.
Like, those are two different senses, and they can exist at the same time.
They can.
They can be experienced and they do. At the same time.
Exactly, they can and they do. And sometimes, like we might, if we do have, for intercultural competence, adaptability and flexibility is a major thing. Can we allow ourselves to operate inside mechanical time? Sometimes we need to. Mm-hmm. Often I need to. But can I develop the skills to learn this other way, and this other way of being? You know, maybe it's a different time in my life, or maybe it's like, I don't know, that could occur inside one 24-hour period, one day, or maybe it's like seasons of my life. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think, I mean, it's there's skill and beauty in adaptability, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you saw immediately like what we're missing in denigrating, right? And in the denigration, we don't allow ourselves to try to develop the skill set, right?
Also, another thing, I don't think the denigration was intentional, right? It was kind of implicit. It was kind of like,
yeah.
I don't think the person who wrote this recognized that they were minimizing the experience of the polychronic person, you know, culture.
100%
as well.
Agree.
So I think that happens a lot.
Yep.
But when we're intentional about like honoring both and recognizing that the gift in each,
yeah,
that can create.
It's just a value that comes out subtly in the language, in the description of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, Roxy.
That's an absolutely American thing that we do. I don't know if they do it everywhere else, but we will say something, and the person hearing it will make a flip in their mind saying, that person is saying, I'm against the other. Mm-hmm. Because I'm for this. Yeah. I have to be against the other. I mean, we do it in politics all the time.
We do. We do. So sometimes maybe, I mean, even if it's not, yeah. So the interpretation is on us.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There is that too. Let's try some others. For Americans, time is a valuable commodity, something to be measured and used wisely. Americans manage their lives according to schedules, which are often divided into hourly, daily, weekly, monthly, and even yearly segments. Deadlines and due dates are a constant reminder of when projects must be completed. This is in contrast to other cultures, such as Mexico, where it is considered important to get to know the other person before initiating business discussions. Maybe this isn't the best example, but where it is in contrast. For Americans, time is a valuable commodity. In contrast to other cultures, where getting to know each other and spending all the time it takes to get to know each other is considered valuable before you do your business, before you, you know, engage in your business. Time is often filled in instead of something else. Time is used in place of something else. Because we can say in Mexico, we could say in Mexico, people value time so much they're willing to, or I'm sorry.
Whoa.
How do I say it? I'll just go right here. Certain kinds of agency are valuable when I went to Americans. For shorthand, we'll say time. When it's really something else, that's the valued thing. So if we take time out of any sentence and instead use the other word that it's, you know, is it efficiency? Is it punctuality? Is it productivity? Is it relationship building? So certain kinds of agency are valuable to Americans. For shorthand, we say time is valued, but we support that claim with evidence of a task orientation. Time is valuable, so much so that we do as much as we can, as fast as we can. But that's not time being valued. That's productivity. That's efficiency. That's, you know, right? The implication is other less developed cultures don't value time because they're not punctual in the same way. That's not the same thing. Mm-hmm. We can say they value relationships. We can say they value getting to know their business partners, right? It's not time.
I have a friend who completed a Fulbright, and one of the things she was struck by, it was in the Netherlands, is that we like to say we're busy.
Oh, yeah.
And there, that would be considered a liability, like that you're not in charge of your time and that you could design your life better than that and not, you know, and that there was a big shift, like, you know, just.
Busy as status.
Busy as, yeah. Yeah, importance and status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Years and years ago at a conference I went to hear somebody who analyzed end of the year sort of holiday letters, dear friends and family, the year has flown. We've been so busy. And over and over again, it was busy, 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 busy. And then it was part of this whole, you know, example of that's supposed to be a good thing, right? Yeah. Oh, who was it who said busyness is the enemy of strategy? Or of intentionality. If I'm super busy, I can't be as intentional about what I actually doing what I actually care about. Mm-hmm. A little more. A parallel sentence if I flipped the bias. A parallel sentence I wrote. The continuing value Mexicans place on time is illustrated by corporate practices in which persons doing business spend much time getting to know each other building relationships that are intended to and may well last beyond the immediate deal. In contrast to America, business people in Mexico value time. Americans value the bottom line.
Amen.
I mean, there's ways that could have been written, uh-huh. and but it, that would never show up in an American textbook. The French do not share the American sense of urgency to accomplish tasks. Your turn. Over and over and over again, it's this implicit comparison, right? And again, Americans do not share the French desire to take all the appropriate time that a task necessitates. Like we can and do. Shame each other. I'll go on. You get the idea. Mm-hmm. We could do this for days. Okay. Let's go on. So normalizing, so there's this normalization that you can see that I saw, right? Of privileging a certain kind of focus on efficiency and not focusing on a relationship, a business relationship or any kind of relationship, right? Now, to be fair, intercultural communication as a discipline came about really post-World War II in response to the federal government and business and industry sending workers overseas, right? And finding that it wasn't just that you needed to speak another language, there was different ways of understanding life, right? And so this whole discipline, the federal government in fact paid and, you know, hired a number of cultural anthropologists to help train federal workers and business workers, like with IBM, for example, and how to be more successful in business. And so this whole, a lot of my, the origins of my discipline came as that of like, tell us what to do. Tell us, you know, how to, you know, never, you know, don't use these symbols anywhere you go because that's obscene in most places around the world, you know, and they wanted lists. But they didn't get at sort of deeper values and respecting those deeper values of why the, you know, people behave the way they do, why we behave the way we do, right? So clock time is a virtue. It's a skill, but it's also there's a value associated with it. And some of that came post-industrialization, not, you know, if we had more time and I had more expertise, and I don't have expertise in religion, but some of the scholars that I read have talked about the long roots of Jewish and Christian tradition about the origin of time built into those religious traditions, about an origin of time and creation and the, you know, and this idea of a linear time being also related to Christianity. And so those who know more than me can talk about other images and other ways, other spirals in Mayan time, right? That's much more associated with a different way of understanding time than a linearity of a ribbon, right? Or of past, present, future timeline. But this notion of the way that we understand it is a mechanism for disciplining us, for ordering us, that what passes for quote-unquote the natural rationality of linear time is a set of cultural claims about the efficacy of law and a specific technologies of social ordering. And so if we imagine the clock, a calendar, as a disciplinary function, as a structuring organism, right? And we use it well. We use it well against each other. We use it well against ourselves. And there's so many things around me that help me to imagine clock time more important and separate me from natural time. Like even when I go to the grocery store, And I can buy things not in season. I can buy strawberries all the time, and even though they're not, you know, like in the wintertime, maybe they don't taste as good, but there are ways that my grocery store separates me from the natural growing seasons, right?
Right.
That's sort of like this, that sort of takes me away from nature. There's a lot of things that can disassociate me from more natural rhythms, and that's certainly one, right? But so even a simple foray there, we can take these principles and say, how am I being encouraged to rely on a clock and not on weather? I mean, I sometimes will go to my weather app instead of walking outside. So yeah, I do sometimes to find the weather. Of course, railroads had a lot to do with standardization, right, in the United States, and a lot of you can probably speak to that. Towns, cities, and towns pre-railroad had their own public time pieces, their own public systems of time. So what might be 12:40, the next town over might be 1:00. Right, and so with the standardization of this correct time, with standard railway time, there was a way of getting everybody together, getting everybody on the same page. And so this notion of correct time, as this was being implemented across the states, the furnishing of correct time, said Leonard Waldo, is educational in its nature, for it inculcates in the masses a certain precision in doing the daily work of life, which conduces perhaps to a sounder morality. A social ordering, a discipline, a keep a watch on my workers, a keep a watch on myself, right? For what purpose? I don't know. Just little images of shaming, your late tardiness. Oh my gosh. Oh. I work with my intercultural communication classes. We partner with World Relief, which is one of the agencies in the United States that helps with refugees transition into the United States. And in the Quad Cities, it's a fairly active World Relief office. And my students have friendships with families, and they see each other once a week. And so we have learned how World Relief teaches and helps with the transitions for new refugees into the United States. And very often, one of the first things that they try, that they mention is that in America, time is money. And the most important thing you need to know is the alarm clock. And, and what this means and how to behave. Because in America, like, you won't necessarily get second chances if you mess this up. And so it's time, right? Lateness. I did, when you mentioned, Nick, early on, that you had been late a lot, I think of a friend of ours. Vicki and I have a friend in common at Augustana College who's late a lot. And we had a conversation about a study that said folks who are late a lot tend to be more optimistic. I don't know if it's causal correlational, I don't know. But I just thought it was lovely. And it absolutely, that fits Wendy, right? Who was late a lot because she, everywhere she goes, she'd be like, hey, Joe, blah, 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 blah. And she's late to the meeting again. But there's an optimism as well, and like, I think I can get there. I think I can get there in 2 minutes. Like, really, it always takes 5, right? Right. And I thought that was kind of a sweet way to sort of lessen this. So what? You were shaking your head. You didn't have something. Okay. So, yeah. Okay.
I mean, I've heard the opposite, that people who are late are selfish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's
judgmental,
right? It certainly is. That's one of the, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I hear that much more than the other. But it also can be no judgment at all, and just a description. You're 5 minutes late. Mm. But we don't often do just flat-out description, mm-hmm. right, without trying to interpret or evaluate. Uh-huh. That's also key to intercultural competency, is to take a judgment out of it and just simply describe. Mm-hmm. You know? Just simply describe without any judgment. Roxy.
Mom used to say, if you're there, if you're not there 10 minutes early, you're not on time.
Yeah.
And now that I'm older, I realize what he was talking about.
Yeah.
If you're like 5 minutes late, you miss like sometimes the most important thing for you to know. And it also disturbs. And I still, she used to play the piano and practice. She was really pretty good at playing the piano. She practiced so much. Because she was waiting for all the rest of us to get around and
lots of practice time.
Right. Well, and when somebody brings two or three young children to church, mm-hmm. I make a point of thanking them for coming. Yeah. Because I know what that means.
What that takes to just get there.
They went through hell before they got to church.
Yes! Yes.
Exactly.
And 10 minutes later, not.
Right.
They're there. Yes. Right.
Certainly yeah. I wouldn't blame them if they were late.
No. I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I love that. I love this image. And I love, like, in some of the, it's been years since I studied about Mayan time, but the spiral is a part of this, is much more, it's connected to the world in a way that this is attractive to me in a way I can't explain.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that?
It says kid time up there, I think.
Kid time?
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a word. It's cut off. You can't quite make it out under the 12.
V-I something time?
Vid time?
Could be a V or a Y.
I don't know what that is.
It's kid time.
Let's say kid time. I'll take it. Oh,
speaking of time,
it is. Oh goodness, yes, it is. It's time. Yeah,
yeah.
Woo! I'm just going to show you a couple quick. But no, you know what? It is. The bell said.
I don't mind.
We're
staying
done.
A couple minutes. Oh, that's not probably for me.
That's right. We can stay more. I just want to sort of share really quickly just a few things like what this tells us and what it doesn't. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they separate people out into like men versus women, or you know, age groups versus other age groups, and all different relational statuses and time use surveys that say something, but they don't tell us what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And so I have a real problem with this stuff, even though I know it's good in some ways. I hate doing time use data where it says how what did you do at work, because I feel like I worked 15 hours today, but if I have to tell you the exact metric, it doesn't get at it, right? And so the psychology of it, our lived experience, and the actual metrics, like there's something very important missing. And here, college students apparently sleep more. And we're supposed to know something about that, supposed to say something. But who feels like they have 3 hours of leisure? No college student I know would ever say they had that kind of leisure. Huh. They work so hard. But the actual minutes might say, this is unstructured time, right? We're going to call it leisure and not work. When we say, you know, actual time, the psychological time, often there's this notion, it's an economic notion of time scarcity. If we don't have enough of something that's vital, then often there's a kind of a sense of panic, like if I don't have enough air. Mm-hmm. When people feel like they don't have enough time, mm-hmm. their bodies respond. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's physiological response to an idea of time scarcity, which is, I'm nervous, I can be anxious, I'm worried, your heart rate goes, I mean, it's stressful.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And We are always, like, there's so many messages that have these expectations. Expectations of parenting, expectations of who we think we're supposed to be. We have expectations about when things are supposed to happen when. Mm-hmm. What's supposed to happen when? Well, I'm this old. Shouldn't I be in this place now in my life? Yeah. Right? So scripts that we have for life scripts, but also the everydayness. Time scarcity is an issue that is, to a certain extent, if we are aware of it as being thrust upon us, we can combat it a little, simply sometimes with cognitive restructuring, sometimes, but by, you know, because you know what? We do have the time that we need. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I talk to my students about that and say, you know what? Just say that, calm. What can we do to battle this? Remind ourselves we do have the time we need. Doesn't seem like strong enough to battle that current. But one last thing that I'll leave you with is this, not my idea, but I love it. Robinson and Godby I believe, political scientists who wrote about some conclusions that spoke to me. Perhaps the most critical variable in how satisfying future time use will be, they say, revolves not so much around technology, efficiency, or the reorganization of society, but around people's ability to appreciate. Mm-hmm. And they do time use studies. How do we portion out our times? How do we spend our days? And they ended up saying instead of time-saving skills, maybe we can cultivate time-savoring skills in order to appreciate the simpler delights of life as they are occurring. The taste of good food, the presence of good company, and the delights of good fun and silliness.
Sounds like Holden. Yeah.
It completely sounds like Holden to me. That's what I said last time I did this. And there's like, in cultivating gratitude, I believe, is one way to enhance our sense of time expansion, because I notice something about you, or I notice something about this place, and if I take the time to express gratitude in my head or appreciation, you know, to a person, about a thing, there's something that's calming about that that perhaps can help us when we live in this incredibly fast-paced time scarce.
But without the daily schedule.
I can appreciate the daily schedule. I appreciate it. But yes. Yeah.
This is something that's very important to know for the staff here, because the staff are very
monochronic.
The guests are trying to be very polychronic.
Yeah.
And so the staff needs to understand that and try to shift gears to blend with the guests, so that the guests have that polychronic experience.
I think the staff are amazing because they have to do, they have a load of work, and it is a monochronic sort of like a stuff you have to get done. But the way I interact with people, guests, I think, are just like wanting to have full-on conversations with staff all the time, and I have never felt dissed by a staff member. And that's got to be hard. And that is multiple skill sets that they have to balance. And I am forever impressed by that. And I do wish that there was some way that, because I feel like I come here and I think Holden operates really well because it does both. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I wish that the staff had more space to experience what I feel like I get from being here. And I wish that for, I don't know how to give them that. But, yeah.
I sit at the table, I talk to everybody that sits around me, wherever I sit, doesn't matter. I can't tell the staff from the
guests. I know.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That is cool and wonderful. I was sitting with the director one time, didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And we were just having a great old time. And I've met people that are really big shots on the outside.
Yes.
And they are just...
Yes.
Just like we are.
And that's a beautiful gift too. Here, yes. And that's in like how, like who has to wait on who, and who, like right. Like the way that power, like power is built into a hierarchy of, the important people can keep you waiting, but you can't keep them waiting. Like, you know, that's in monochronic systems, the hierarchy is super huge.
10 minutes but for here. Professors.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
20 for full professors, right?
And tonight, the last part of this.
Good fun and silliness.
Oh yeah, be sure you go to the silly stuff.
Silly stuff.
Yeah, they're going to have the show, the talent show.
The variety show? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That sounds really fun.
Oh yeah.
Is that 8? I'm helping host it, but it's like at 8 right after Vespers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah.
Fun.
That works.
Yeah.
Thank you all for being here and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So fun to study this.